Welcome to the Oceania Healthcare Limited full year results announcement for FY24. All participants are in a listen-only mode. First, we will hear a presentation followed by the question and answer session. If you are participating in the teleconference, please ensure your webcast audio is muted to avoid an echo. You can mute the sound in the lower corner of the video player. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Brent Pattison, Chief Executive Officer, Kathryn Waugh, Chief Financial Officer, and Heath Milne, Head of Capital Markets and M&A. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you everyone, and a very warm welcome. I'm delighted to be presenting our financial results for full year 2024. This will be my last annual results briefing as CEO of Oceania. And it's been an absolute honour to join you each year and to see how the business has changed and adapted and succeeded in a tough market over the last few years. Oceania is a team, and it's our people's daily efforts that makes this business so great. I get to see our team in action every day, and there are just so many moments of brilliance, empathy, professionalism and innovation, where our residents truly feel the outworking of our Believe in Better promise. Well done, team. You have made my role so rewarding. And I'm very proud of each and every one of you. To the market participants and commentators, I've enjoyed your questions, your interest and dedication to our business. We haven't always agreed, but we have learned together and we have a better business for it. To our residents, it's certainly been a privilege of mine to get to know so many of you personally over the years. It's wonderful to have our residents' lives captured in our presentation and annual reporting materials. And lastly, to our shareholders, I thank you for your investment in us, your confidence in us, and your continued support. So turning to the financial results, I can tell you it's always a bonus as an exiting CEO to have a set of numbers that demonstrate a positive direction of travel, a transformation of a business and an execution of a strategy. The team have worked hard to put us in a favourable financial position. At a P&L level, we have seen a significant increase in our total comprehensive income of $70.5 million, up 104%, and our non-GAAP measures of underlying EBITDA, $82.6 million, which is up 3%, and underlying net PAT, which is 62.1 million, up 6% on PCP. Operating cash flow and new cash from sales of occupational right agreements, what we call ORAs, have been strong performers at 85.4 million, up 22%, and 226.3 million, up 27% on PCP. The deleveraging of Oceania is well underway, with total net debt headroom improving from 88.5 million on the 31st of March 2024 to around $100 million today. We're also in compliance with all banking covenants, and Kathryn will expand on the success of these measures in her section of the presentation. We have continued to add to the quality of the Oceania portfolio with the delivery of 182 units and care suites in full year 2024, and we are well advanced on next year's pipeline of 224 units and care suites. It's been pleasing to note the success of our divestment program, with six assets sold or under contract as at 31st March 2024. And I will touch on this I'll touch on this in more detail shortly. Pleasingly also, we are well underway on our climate-related disclosure reporting, and this will be published next month. Oceania is a business that's been investing in its growth, and the directors have resolved to not pay a final dividend as we conclude the more intensive components of this growth and portfolio transformation stage. Turning to slide three, transformation through innovation. I've been part of a wonderful team that set itself an ambitious plan of transforming Oceania through innovation, capital investment, and a genuine desire to reimagine the retirement and aged care sector. The graphic shows Oceania's progress from the IPO in 2017 through to today. And as it turns out, while I was not yet employed by Oceania at that time, I was part of a group of investment banking advisors to the IPO and as such have journeyed with Oceania since 2017. It is pleasing to see that we have grown the assets of Oceania by over 200% to nearly $3 billion and operating cash flows by more than 100% to $85.4 million. People have often heard me say we deliver critical infrastructure and essential services, and with this in mind, we set about modernising and transforming the portfolio of properties to the highest levels of HomeStar certification. We pioneered the introduction of the nurse practitioner model during those tough COVID years. This provided a dual benefit for Oceania, firstly, career pathways and retention of our clinical staff, and secondly, personalised high-quality care for our residents when traditional New Zealand GP practices were in decline. We ambitiously tied our five-year, $500 million sustainability-linked loan to performance targets that focused on resident well-being, allowing our residents to evaluate our daily service and care for them and let us know how we were performing. We made staying together in later life possible with the introduction of couples care suites and have taken the next step of providing a private, personalised care offering at The Helier. Strategic investment decisions. Oceania, as you are aware, has been an active industry participant in building, buying, selling and curating a modern, premium and resident-centred portfolio of villages and care properties. Since IPO, Oceania has delivered over 1,350 new units and care suites across the full spectrum of property typologies, with the greatest weighting towards high-quality premium apartments and care suites. We've also had an active M&A agenda, having completed over 21 capital transactions since IPO, 6 acquisitions and 15 divestments or closures. In the full year 2024, we have sold, exited or have under advanced contracts a total of 9 property divestments. What is of importance is that in aggregate, these divestments have netted circa $40 million of cash proceeds for deleveraging Oceania and supporting new growth opportunities, and have been transacted with various purchasers in aggregate above book value. Some nice pictures of developments that we've completed in full year 2024. If we start with the left-hand side, the Bayview, in 24 we delivered 28 further units, the Pahutukawa stage. Bayview development started with a new care building, which has been fully occupied and built up a great reputation in the region. The site development then turned to apartments, and we are now over 100 apartments across 3 stages. With harbour views to the Mount, the Bayview is Tauranga's best-kept secret, which we are unlocking for residents. We also highlight the stages of development potential located on the site, and this is in the picture highlighted in green. Turning to The Helier, it's a standing joke in the office that there are very few people that Brent hasn't taken to The Helier to show them around. But the truth is, it just gets better every time I see it. It was born out of significant market research and deep resident insight. We have an integrated building, sensitive to its location and landscape, that delivers outstanding convenience and hotel-like services for both our independent and private care residents. We've also acquired neighbouring properties on the northeast boundary, providing protection of views and a future stage of development to connect the two roads. The Helier is a premium product, and it was opened in stages due to the impact of COVID and weather-related delays. The completed common areas were blessed and opened in August 2023, and our private paying care was opened on Valentine's Day in February 24, of which we have seen strong demand for this new care offering. We are just over 25% of the apartments sold and under application, and nearly 20% of the care residences. The softer housing market continues to have an impact as people wait to see where rates are heading. While the total sales proceeds are significant at circa $60 million from these initial sales and applications, we were expecting a stronger start. However, given the premium nature of the offering, the elevated inquiry levels since official opening, we expect to be cash neutral within the full year 25. We turn to the next page. Redwood and Blenheim, the delivery of 55 care suites at the Redwood Village is another example of right product, right place in the heart of Blenheim with our award-winning gardens. The Redwood Village has been part of Oceania's portfolio since the late 80s, and the recent completion of the care suite building has been well received by the local market. We already have 9 applications processed following our official opening, and a wonderful karakia in Waiata led by Rangi Tani Iwi on a beautiful sunny day on 8th of May. The Bellevue. We completed all stages of our planned development at the Bellevue Village with the recently completed 46 apartments as seen in the image. This provides a fully integrated site comprising of 68 apartments and 71 care suites in a key location in Christchurch. We have 100% sold all prior stages of apartments and achieved significant pre-sale success for this final stage of these apartments. We have settled and recognised 15 of the 46 apartments in the full year 24 and have a further 12 apartments under application. In essence, we have well over 50% of the village sold or under application within the first 6 months of opening. Turning to our development pipeline, Oceania is well underway with next year's development program. We have circa $147 million of development debt work in progress, with all buildings nearing completion early in our full year 25 year to allow for the maximum time for new sales and pre-sale cash collection. By December 2024, we will have completed circa 85% of the 264 units and care suites under construction across 3 locations in Auckland. We will have concluded the last stage of development at our Awatere Village in Hamilton with 68 apartments. At our Meadowbank Village, we have undertaken a 40-room, clinically researched and resident-designed dementia building. And this is a very fitting way to complete all stages of development at Meadowbank, a journey that started over 10 years ago with apartments now 193, care suites now 63, and a bunch of happy, settled residents with high levels of satisfaction and occupancy. The last graphic on the slide is an aerial photo of our greenfield site, Namara, which means the gardens, and this is in Franklin. With site works complete, we are well underway with the construction of a multi-year, multi-stage development of a wonderful new Oceania community. The renders to the right provide impressions of our finished community centre, the entrance and villas. The last slide for me, strategy and portfolio transformation. Since IPO, we've added over 1,350 premium units and care suites, and this has transformed Oceania's portfolio into a modern, market-leading and high-quality portfolio. We have observed significant sales price growth over the period 2017 through to today, with apartments up 2.6 times to an average sales price of $970,000 and care suites up 1.7 times to an average sales price of $338,000 and nearly a doubling of the average price for our villa product. In reshaping and repositioning Oceania's portfolio, we have simplified the offering as we have pivoted our portfolio to the present and future requirements of our residents. To put this in context, around 85% of our total independent property valuation is represented in 21 of these village and care properties. These 21 village and care sites are either brand new or have had major development within the last 5 to 6 years and have an average building age of 3 years or less. These are new, modern and resident design buildings with minimal ongoing maintenance required, delivering exceptional resident service and quality outcomes. And they have been built with a 50-year expected life. As communicated at our half year, we've been rebalancing the overall product mix with 44% independent living and 56% care, with a stated intention of getting to 50-50 as we build out the rest of the portfolio. We are proud of what's been achieved at Oceania and the transformation of the portfolio. We have also had an eye to the future, and we have an attractive, well-positioned land bank across 16 sites in the Golden Triangle, Central North Island and populated South Island locations. These 16 sites are already part of the Oceania family and provide over 1,500 consented units and care suites for future stages of development. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to hand now to Catherine Waugh, our Chief Financial Officer.
Thank you, Brent, and thank you, everyone, for dialing in today. We have provided in the appendices a pro forma for analysts on the call. This records the impact of divested and exited sites to allow for like-for-like comparisons of earnings. I will walk you through the rest of the slides and then we will open for questions. Full information can be seen in our financial statements and the appendices to this presentation. Our annual report this year shows a clear step towards evolving our integrated thinking and integrated reporting practices. The inclusion of additional metrics and targets in the annual report to accompany our financial statements is just one step in this process. I'm happy to say that as a team, we have made great inroads on our sustainability and integration roadmap since we last spoke. In refining our value creation model, we have really been getting under the hood using the Six Capitals framework to enhance our assessment of what drives true long-term sustainable value and performance. Aligning our value creation model with our strategic pillars and exploring the utilisation of different capitals and business activities has helped us do this. Slide 10 details a small subset of this year's wins in relation to enhanced metrics, measuring the progress against our sustainability framework, which we introduced last year. Calling out just a few, we have met all three of our sustainably linked loan and performance targets this year. We have exceeded our construction waste diversion, we have exceeded our care resident wellbeing target, and we have had our targets for GHG emissions validated by the Science Based Target Initiative, as well as seen a reduction in our scopes 1 and 2 emissions. In relation to the offer pillar, we now have 10 projects, a total of 495 units, which are certified to Homestar 6, and we are aiming for our first Homestar 7 project under the much stricter version 5 at Namara in Franklin, Auckland. Resident and people pillars have also seen a number of significant wins this year, with both our care resident and employee NPS stats increasing. While all this has been happening, the team have also been working hard to understand climate risks and opportunities over the short, medium and long term. In our first year as a climate reporting entity, we've completed lots of groundwork in relation to identifying and assessing physical and transitional risks and potential implications. We will be releasing our first climate risk disclosure statements in the next month or so, and our GHG emissions report has been loaded to the website today. At the start of this presentation, Brent touched on our statutory GAAP metrics. Here on screen, we have provided some of the non-GAAP measures and some of the highlights to our results. All in all, it's been a very favourable result this year with positive trends in all of our key measures. For our care segment, we have seen an almost 11% increase in care premiumisation, testament to the premiumisation journey which we've been on. For our village segment, we have seen an 18% increase in new sales volumes, a 14% increase in resales volumes, and an associated 14% increase in capital gains. It's really pleasing to see these favourable green shoots after the last few years of downward pressure. Overall, despite a 2.7% decrease in underlying earnings at the interim, we have been able to deliver a result which is 3% up and 6% up at the underlying EBITDA and underlying NPAT levels respectively. When looking at the balance sheet, we continue a disciplined and diligent approach around capital allocation and have complied with all covenants. Our headroom of $85 million has increased since balance date to a healthy $100 million today, and we have a clear route to reducing our gearing levels. I will run through some of the detail behind these points on the coming slides, and we'll take questions on them at the end. Finally, for this slide, I want to touch on the divestment program. The strategic focus has been going exceptionally well with two operating sites and a land bank settling during the 12-month period and two operating sites settling in April and May. We have a further site currently under contract. Appendix 5 to this pack provides a view of the pro forma group underlying earnings for the sites that have been divested and exited in the reporting periods. As can be seen from the appendix, the earnings impact of the sites which we've sold was minimal. However, the conversion of value to cash for these sites has had a worthy impact to our debt position and ensures appropriate use of our capital. We still have a handful of other sites earmarked for divestment to complete this program. A month or so ago, we provided an indication of our sales volumes over the period. As some pointed out at that time, while our volumes were up year on year, the second half of FY24 had seen slightly less sales than the first half. Pleasingly, however, during the second half, we have seen strong margins. On slide 12, we provide context to the sales we've experienced over the last 12 months. When looking year on year, we have seen increases in a number of areas, namely new sales volumes, resale volumes, and ILU sales. Care Suite sales have been consistently strong year on year, maintaining sales volumes of 250 plus. We've recently delivered Care Suites at Redwood in Blenheim, and the Elmwood Care Suite building will be ready for occupation later this year. Together with our existing portfolio of Care Suites, we are confident that we will continue to see strong demand for that product. Development margins have continued to moderate, something we have signalled for a while. Our resale margins continue to hold strong, testament to our product and the demand for our established product. On the right-hand side, we provide our average sales prices. This cycle, we have provided the detail of our new sales and our resales separately. We've achieved pricing which is just as strong in our resale product as our new sale product, and we've achieved price increases in all categories throughout our resale stock. New sale pricing, as we have often highlighted, is dependent on the product, the region, and the timing that the development sites are delivered. So in summary, despite market backdrops, this 12-month period has seen our strongest sales volumes ever at 476 sales. The lighter volumes in the second half have been offset by the strong pricing and therefore margins which we have been able to achieve in the period. In a couple of slides' time, I will talk to the new sales stock which we have on hand, a key driver for future reduction of debt for us. Moving to slide 13 in the care segment. In our care business, we're also seeing positive markers and movements year on year. Premium care revenues have increased 10% year on year, occupancy is creeping back up to pre-COVID levels, and care margins are stable with a road to increase further in future periods. Even more importantly, we are now above the $10,000 EBITDA per bed marker that we set a few years back. You have heard us talk in the past about how we remain confident with our premium care strategy. I have said many times that we had an aspiration to increase our EBITDA per bed, excluding DMF, to over $10,000 per bed, rising to over $17,000 per bed, including DMF. This year we have achieved both, and our aspirations don't end there. We continue to see positive trends with our wages to revenue stabilising, and as an inflationary pressure ease over the coming periods, we will continue to see a positive trajectory in this space. I must stress that the measure of $10,000 per bed relates to the core earnings of care sites, excluding DMF. Including those fees, we have seen an increase to over $18,000 per bed. This is something that will continue to increase, particularly as we bring more Care Suite products to the market. Our confidence in our premium care strategy continues. The EBITDA per bed is one marker. Coupled with the cash collection experience from the observed shorter tenures of 2 to 3 years, and the contribution of Care Suites continues to be a benefit for the group. Shortly, I will address overall debt and gearing. And although we are seeing a pathway to reduce debt, we haven't reached that magic moment just yet. We are still in the tail end of the consequences and impacts of COVID, inflation and a softer housing market and an intensive period of investment in new product. I will talk to the current position now. Our debt is highly weighted to development debt and is supported by both current and future sales stock. On the left of the slide, I provide the usual graphic to provide the snapshot of our current development debt drawn to the value of our underlying development assets. As I have indicated previously, our banking facilities are structured such that once developments are fully paid down, the proceeds from sales can be paid against current development drawings. As a result of this, we are in a position where we hold a healthy 1.15 times coverage of our development debt, At the interim results, we gave you visibility of the unsold development stock which we were holding. On this slide, we have provided an updated position, and we will continue to provide this slide moving forward until the point that we get to lower levels of development stock on hand. As I said back then, this is a key insight into how our current and future development stock will be used to repay development debt. We currently have $147 million of our development debt, which is development work in progress. This is up from $97 million in September as a result of the timing of completion of our developments. This will be recovered post-completion and in future periods. Unsold stock. This represents the cash recycling from the developments that I touched on. The faster we release these funds through sales to pay down our development debt, the faster we will return to gearing levels in the mid-30s. Unsold stock has reduced by $69 million in the last 6 months, from $422 million at the end of September to $353 million to the end of March. With an average sales price per unit of $327,000, care suites totaling $51 million are currently occupied with transferred and PAC residents. These care suites represent 15% of the total unsold stock at March and importantly represent sales for future periods. These units are not readily realisable but also provide an ongoing operating cash flow and reduced slightly since September. Of the remaining balance, 60% or $213 million relates to unsold new stock which was completed in the last 12 months. This includes key developments, the Helier, the Bellevue, the Bayview and Redwood, and is down $42 million from September. Finally, the remaining 25% or $88 million of the unsold new stock, which is readily available for sale, relates to developments completed more than 12 months ago. Momentum is now on our side. We continue to focus on sales and particularly to reduce our level of stock on hand. Cash to be unlocked in future periods. My last slide of today touches on the balance sheet. As you will have seen from the previous slide, we are positioned well to sell through our current stock and move our gearing back to the low to mid-30s. We are coming off the back of a number of large care and apartment deliveries. The timing of these developments has not been ideal, and as we came out of the COVID years and delivered to one of the toughest sentiment markets that New Zealand has seen. This has resulted in large levels of drawn debt, debt that has seen a peak as flat as Table Mountain. In our favour, though, has been a low average cost of debt as a result of well-timed corporate bonds, a well-timed refinance, and a capital raise back at the beginning of the cycle. With this groundwork complete, our next refinancing event does not occur until FY2028. This has meant that we have been able to maintain headroom on our covenants and have not needed waivers from our banking syndicate, despite the tough trading environment. And we are at 3.4 times ICR with a 2 times covenant, and we expect it to increase from here. Our loans are organised so that we can switch between development and corporate facilities, with favourable margins in the second half and pleasing progress with the divestment programme. We have seen our headroom increase from $88.5 million at the reporting date to circa $100 million today. Further to this, Brent spoke earlier to how 85% of our current developments will be delivered by the end of this calendar year. With future developments, you will see us focus more on villa product, a product which cash can be recovered more quickly. We are also in control of our own destiny as to where we deploy our capital and when. Thank you everyone for your time today. I am joined in the room by Brent and Heath, and we will now hand back to the operator and open the call for questions.
Thank you. A reminder that if you are participating in the teleconference, please ensure your webcast audio is muted to avoid an echo. You can mute the sound in the lower corner of the video player. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Bianca Flodoris with UBS. Please go ahead.
Morning, Brent, Catherine and Heath. So first question from me is just around your new unit sale prices on slide 12. So overall, that's looking good, but apartment new sale prices fell. And I know you mentioned that depends on geography and product, but I was a bit surprised by that given that's what the Helier will be included in. So would you be able to talk about what's driving that decline?
Yep, good question, Bianca. I think for us it was really just a mix. So if we think about the Helier, the influence in that FY24 year has only been 13 ILU and 4 care products. So as a consequence, we haven't yet seen the material uptick that's going to occur in the apartment side. We've been selling through, obviously, some of our Awatere product in Hamilton, which has Elisa Value, Bayview, Eden, the last of Eden, Bellevue, etc. So most of it is actually just mix rather than anything that we see untoward in our actual apartment levels. Looking ahead, we obviously see stabilising pricing in the market. We haven't been a price taker, we've been a price setter, and we're expecting levels to be up around that, if not well in excess of that, as we sell through some of this premium product.
Okay, thanks, Brent. And then just following up on the Helier, so you mentioned 25% of apartments are sold or under application and 20% of care suites. Could you share what percentage are actually sold?
So we have 13 ILU that have been recognised in April 24, and we have 4 care residents. We have 7 under application where we've seen settlements in May, April and May of ILU, and 2 additional applications for care residents.
Okay. So you mentioned the residential property market is still challenging and impacting sales at that village. And so with these more recent ones, I guess, did you have to lower prices at that village or offer any sort of increased incentives?
We haven't lowered prices, no, and I know that's a question that's been on people's minds. It's actually been more just about confidence. People love the product. Lots of people are sitting there waiting for a stabilisation in market. It's less about their expectations of what they're going to get from their homes, because a lot of the homes are obviously in the $5-7 million range that they are selling. They just want confidence that if they market and go through that change, that there's going to be a willing buyer on the other end. So it's actually been less about market prices and more actually about an incoming buyer. Are they going to be able to finance it? Are they going to be able to afford that financing at higher interest rates? As Adrian moves us to hopefully lower interest rates towards the end of this year or early next year, then I just think that it will help with sentiment. So people love the product, people are happy with the price, people are happy with the services, but they need to see some confidence. And as people know, there's an abundance of listings. So eventually the market will clear that abundance of listings.
Yeah, okay. But so based on that, it sounds like first half of 25 may still be quite weak on sales for the Helier, and then hopefully we'll see an improvement in sort of second half of 25 for that village?
Yeah, I think we're not necessarily seeing it the same as that, but I think we're just being cautious. And we know that it's something that people have focused, it's a flagship property for us, so we're being cautious. But what we have done is run various scenarios. And under each of those scenarios, we're confident that we will be cash positive with the sales that we'll make out to FY25. So we would have recovered our investment effectively.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And then also there was a decent uplift in payments to suppliers and employees. And I remember you mentioned that the Helier would have high OPEX from day one. So could you talk about what drove the uplift and how much of that is driven by the opening of the Helier?
Yeah, hi Bianca, it's Catherine here. I haven't got specific numbers for the call, but yeah, as you mentioned, a few of our sites, because of the timing of opening, will be running at a slight operating loss for the few months, and the Helier being one, and also some of the other developments Brent has spoken to. That's natural in the cycle of it, and because of the level of service that we provide and the experience that we want for residents, we've always had the motto that the operating model will be there 100% on day one, even if there's only one resident, and that will decrease over time. The other thing you will have seen is in our village segment, there's an intentional additional investment in marketing spend in particular. We've been putting some more money into brand awareness. You guys, if you got on early for the call, will have seen our recent TVC campaign. So we're really proud of what that's done and the insights it's bringing to future residents, and there's intentional spend from that.
Okay, and will that continue into FY25? The marketing.
I think what happens. Yeah. So what happens? The latest advertisement, Father and Son, is part of a series of properties that we had. So the first property was our residents telling their stories. The second property was around a couple playing a piano in our care suites. The third property was around some residents moving into our apartments and taking their treasured dining room table. And the last has really been this notion around the care and the quality of care that we provide. So as a person's needs change, we are there. And I'm sure you love the theme song around sort of Lean On Me. And that's part of what we're trying to get to. That is the last of a major spend. We've seen significant increase in familiarity, brand awareness, and we're, you know, excited with the properties that we've developed. So that marketing will taper. Where that marketing gets directed, Bianca, is into our inquiry levels, into our research in resident insights to drive. It's more demand driven around improving our sales cadence and performance.
Okay. Great, thanks. And then last question for me. So you disposed of some assets in FY24, so more in the first half of 25. Is that essentially the completion of your disposal program, or are there any other assets you are considering selling?
No, there are some more left there, Bianca. In our financial statements, we have a disclosure as to the quantum of those. So, yeah, there are still a handful, but we'd hope to have those underway by the end of 30 September. So at the interim, you'll hear more from us on those.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's all for me.
Your next question comes from Ari Decker with Jarden. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, and thanks for the presentation. Just starting on the development pipeline, so you've given a clear steer to nearing completion for most of it in 25. Outside of Meadowbank and Franklin, where you're sort of commencing earthworks, are you going to commence anything else into FY25? And can you just talk about, you know, what we should be sort of expecting based on that for delivery into FY26? Because it's looking a bit thin if you don't.
It's interesting, Ari, because as we build, our debt goes up, so we get hammered for that. But also, we're in a situation where we need to obviously sort of temper that pipeline. So if we think about into FY26, we're moving into these broad acre developments, and they allow for staging, they allow for acceleration of capital if necessary. Two obvious developments in the Mara, which is in Franklin, in Auckland, but also the acquisition that we did some time back, Breen Bay, which is in Ruakaka, which allowed us to access, you know, a large site across the road as part of that transaction. Coupled with that, we'll be continuing, we said earlier, future site developments at Bayview, future development sites, where at Lady Allum, et cetera. So part of that is the job of the new CEO, I guess, but part of it is also the existing team having a very strong view on right product, right place, and where we are in the cycle. We've had a very, very intensive investment period around apartments and care suites. We're coming out of care suites, we're coming out of apartments, we're going into other product typologies. You can even see with the deliveries that we have in the forecasting for next year, you know, roofs are on and we're starting to get to sort of almost the final stages of those buildings. There's plenty for us to pivot towards, Ari, and it's really a matter of, you know, in that golden triangle where we can see good support for the end product, you know, we're obviously going to go hard. But that'll also be part of, you know, Andrew and the team and the new CEO thinking about where do we want to spend that next dollar in 2026.
And whilst we haven't, over this financial year, started maybe the same amount of development that we have in previous financial years, Andrew's team has remained very active in advancing design processes for our other key sites. Elmwood is a further stage of development there, Lady Allum, and Bream Bay, as Brent mentioned as well.
No, thanks. Yeah, I understand what you're looking to manage. So yeah, the commitments that sit on the balance sheet at end of financial year of $45 million, that pretty much is associated with those completions and finishing at Meadowbank. And in terms of further density, you're not looking to open anything up at this stage in FY25.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a good question, and hopefully that's what we're providing assurance around. So you're exactly right, Ari, that's what it is. You can see in the graphics, you know, scaffolding's coming down, cranes are being removed, roofs are going on, and in some instances, you know, if we think about Elmwood, we're nearly ready to open the building. So a lot of the future debt, if you like, or development debt, is already in train or being spent or has been spent, I guess, to bring that new product to market.
No, that's helpful. And then final question just on this vein of questioning. So the reason you haven't looked to increase your facilities is pretty deliberate. You're essentially, you're not worried about the risk of settlement timing in this market because actually you're not looking to commit to a lot of new development, and so you'll sort of finish off what you committed to. It's not much, and the settlement proceeds sort of come in, and for that reason you haven't looked to increase your facility limit.
You go, Catherine, then.
Brent can add to this, but essentially yes, Aria. I mean, we're sitting at 100 mil of headroom today. That's plenty for what we need with the developments that we've got planned for the next, 12 to 18 months. It's obviously something that we look at regularly. If the time comes in the future, then we will look at it. I talked about key refinance date is out to 28, but obviously we'll address it before we get to that point.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that we're mindful of, Ari, it's not a great time to be negotiating with banks a favourable kind of financing facility at these sort of rates. So one of the hallmarks of Oceania has been to sort of pick windows, I guess, that bring our weighted average cost of capital down, bring diversity and tenure into our facilities, whether that's through bonds, whether that's through a refinancing event that Catherine and I work through, and try and assist with that. But there's plenty of headroom, and this is a deleveraging story for us. You know, we've got some fantastic product that we have in market. We've got a recovering housing market sentiment, albeit it keeps getting kicked down the road, but, you know, we do see a recovering housing market into 25, and we'll be focused on doing what we've done over the last 6 months, getting through that sort of unsold stock and delivering the balance sheet.
Great, thanks. And then just two quick final ones, hopefully. Just on the receivables, that balance of ORA receivables is climbing. You know, the vast majority of it you expect to realise, within 12 months. Catherine, could you just remind us what the approach is there in terms of what drives that growth and the short-term part of that ORA receivable to $74 million now? And then also what's driving the increase of the greater than 12 months from $10 million last year to $20 million this year?
Yeah, thanks, Ari. You're right. The short-term receivable is ticking up at 74 at March. What I would say is, though, and we obviously analyse this every month, the portion of that, there's a high portion that's with it under 3 months. As we bring more and more care suites to market, we are naturally going to see that number increase. Care suites are needs-based product. It's one where we generally offer a 60-day deferral on entry because the person needs to be in that day or that week. And they're generally not having to sell the family home pay that, but it's just a matter of getting the paperwork in order. So it's a low risk thing for us. On the care suites, occasionally we'll allow a portion of an ILU to defer and a small amount for a short term as well. And so it generally will build, but not age, if that makes sense. On the longer term stuff, again, occasionally sometimes we offer a 10% deferral, or what you'll find is some of those have just only marginally ticked into the 12-month period. They're not delayed forever or not delayed till settlement, but they are more than 12 months, so we can't classify them as short term.
Sure. And then final one for you, Brett, and like, I appreciate it's not something you'll be, you know, there to execute on, but, you know, you guys have had some success on getting, you know, close to book or around book for the divestments, albeit pretty small assets. Can you just sort of comment on whether the board has considered divesting assets of larger size, you know, given the large value gap that's there and you know, that being a potential means of sort of looking to close it?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Ari. I mean, it's frustrating when we think about the value gap, you know, and part of that might have been sort of coming out of an index and, you know, and not having a marginal buyer for the stock at that time. But I'm talking about the, you know, the shares, obviously. But, you know, from my perspective, we're in a situation where we look at the capital allocation of our sites. We looked at the portfolio transformation. So where do we want to be? Where do we know that there are, you know, good buying signals for residents? How do we create, you know, fantastic communities for people? And how do we make sure that these have embedded value that goes on? So how do we get that annuity? So Catherine, myself and the team went through and we looked at sort of what's the trade-off between operating earnings, what's the trade-off around maintenance capital, what's the trade-off around competitive environment, what are our capital allocation rules and hurdle rates that we want to hit. That's how we came up with our initial kind of divestment portfolio. But we also know that we've got some crown jewels. So, you know, what do we think about those? Are we the best and highest owner of those in a deleveraging of the balance sheet? At this stage, we've taken a pretty prudent approach. We have tried to demonstrate to the market that we have kept our operating earnings kind of roughly in line and been able to recycle cash. And that's been our primary focus, first and foremost. It will be for somebody else to consider, but I think we're pretty happy with where the portfolio is at. You know, I touched on it earlier, Ari, we've got about 21 of our total sites that represent about 85% of the $3 billion. So we think we've got to the sort of portfolio that we want to keep, and we think that we're going to start to see some pretty attractive annuity DMF coming off that. Our occupancy is lifting, resident satisfaction is lifting, so it's a challenging one.
We're also talking about a market where the you know, the types of sites that we have divested, there's, and we've spoken to before, a theme in the service offering of those sites, largely care focused. And there's a reason why the market that's out there, that's desirable. When you start going into the other end of our portfolio, it doesn't have the same features that obviously that market would look for. So it would be a completely different proposition.
Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from Aaron Ibbotson with Forsyth Barr. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Good morning, and thank you for the presentation. And Brent, good luck with your future plans. You know, thanks for good, robust discussions. I got a couple of questions. I guess my first question is on, you know, what I would call core debt. I'm not sure what you would call it, but basically the difference between what you highlight as development assets and net debt. So, you know, a year ago you had 600 of development assets and 550, call it, of net debt. Now you've still got 600 or 12 of development assets, but 630 of net debt, call it. So, you know, that's a quite material increase, and particularly in the second half there was a big jump. So I'm just trying to understand your view of this and how you expect this core debt to develop as you potentially, depending on what the market does, sell down some of your inventory. Is this core debt going to continue to sort of creep up, this difference between these two numbers?
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. It's Catherine here. It's a good question. Three, 4 years ago, Cordat, we'd really only use it as a kind of, you know, month-on-month working capital to have a buffer, and occasionally from time to time we'd use it for dividends. If you remember when we did the project to purchase Remuera Rise and Bream Bay, we used our Cordat facility at that time, which is why it's ended up at a higher, more stable level. We have also been using it recently to buy small parcels of land, so you will have seen our disclosures where we've been buying a few of the pieces of land at the back of the Helier. So I guess that explains why it's where it is at the moment. To your question about how do we see it,
Buying land should not increase it, because presumably you pay and then you put that land in undeveloped land, no? So I'm looking at slide 14 here, and I'm comparing the 612 with your net debt number. So if you buy land for 20 million, that 612 goes up by 20, and your net debt goes up by 20. So that gap does not open up because of land acquisitions.
Yeah, no, I understand. I was just touching on the drawn amount to start with. So rounding out what I was saying, so the drawn amount, and kind of that's where we've got to the level it is. If I answer your question first about how we see it going forward and what's going to happen with that core debt, we touched on a few times, myself and Brent, about how as we sell down developments, that cash obviously goes against the development facility in the first instance. Going forward, once we're at a cash neutral position, which we're expecting we will be by the end of this next financial year with the Helier, we can use those funds to be kind of allocated against our corporate facility. So that will see us bringing that number right down and having more of a headroom in our working capital. And you'll note this morning you also touched on how we can move between the two facilities, so between our corporate and our development. And so that's kind of the roadmap for where it's going. I don't know if Brent wants to add anything about the...
Sorry, Catherine, I don't really mind which facility you put it in and how much you draw. I'm looking at the total overall amount. Yeah. So you reported net debt of roughly 630, yeah, and development assets of 612. That's a negative 20. At the half year, you reported 634 of development assets and roughly 607 of net debt. That was a 25 million positive. So the way I would think about core debt has gone up by 45 million over the last 6 months. We don't have to call it core debt. We can just call it the difference between these two numbers. So it's gone up by 45 million in the second half. So effectively what I'm saying is your development assets seem to have gone down a lot more than I would have expected, given, you know, what your sales proceeds are and how much CapEx you're spending. So I'm just trying to understand. Maybe these are the Aura receivables or something, but I'm just trying to understand why the difference between these two numbers have gone up by 45 million since the first half.
Yeah, okay, I understand.
So some of that, Aaron, might be buybacks. So that's probably a consideration.
That was positive in the second half, according to disclosures.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think about what is driving that difference that you've just given us. So let us answer it for you offline so that we've got time to just work through that. We don't have the materials in front of us. But if I think about what's happening with the development assets, some of that's going to be valuation, some of that's going to be buybacks, and how we've used the facilities effectively in our switching.
So your unsold new stock, has it been valued down in the half?
Not on mass scale, but yeah, the other point that I'd add to these numbers is these come from a CBRE valuation, so they are subject to movements in things like ingoing prices, even other little changes like parts of sites being changed, the treatment of how they're valued. We've had, parts of sites that have been moved from being treated as development land actually back to going concern, so come out of some of the buckets in here. If you
can really dig down to that level of detail. The other one which you point, which you referenced as well, Aaron, is we refer to on this analysis for, I guess, for conservatism, we refer to unsold stock per our CBRE valuations, which doesn't account for deferred settlements or, yeah, for sites that are, you know, there's a bunch of Helier sales which are not included in our unsold new stock, which settled after balance date, for example. So that receivable is the other side of it.
Yeah, it's just a bit unnerving when these numbers move unexpectedly by such large amounts. But anyway, second question for me. You touched on CapEx and, you know, 100 million being comfortably enough to finish off. I'm not sure if that's a net or a gross number, but I think it would be really helpful for me and maybe for others if you could go through, you know, what CapEx you've got remaining on sort of three or four projects you're finishing this year, so Elmwood, Waterford, and Awatera. You know, how much, I mean, if I look at the pictures, it looks like it's not that much left, but I remember thinking that for the Helier, and there was quite a lot left, so I'm just curious to understand, is this, what, $20 million a village or less? What are we looking here approximately to finish these four listed projects this year?
Yeah.
I appreciate there's other CapEx as well.
Yeah, no, you're right. So I think the easiest way of probably looking at it is if I link back to the question that Ari asked, which was around the, in our stat account where we talk about what are we committed to. So we're committed to another 45 million in the next 12 months. That covers those kind of the top half of the slide that Brent had of the pictures that are underway. That doesn't include the cost of Franklin. We're out for tender on that at the moment, so it includes what we need to finish the earthworks, but not the development as such. So I view it as 45 mil for Elmwood, Waterford, Albertary and Meadowbank, and then Franklin, as we said, we're the controllers of that destiny of when we start. When we do start at stage one will be a handful of villas. We're also going to start the development of the community centre and the care facility at that time.
That's super helpful, Catherine. But just to spell it out now, I guess Ari and I are asking the same questions in different ways. But looking at this then and looking at your sort of wait-and-see approach to a few of the new developments, which, you know, personally makes sense to me, it looks like CapEx can fall pretty dramatically this year and then again next. Is that fair, assuming no other dramatic developments?
Well, we don't have a crystal ball, Aaron, on where the market goes, but I think in essence, yes. I mean, that's all part of this transformation of the portfolio. You know, we grew the portfolio from $900 million to $3 billion, and now we're going through a tapering. You know, we had COVID and other activities that kind of meant that we were truncated with all of our developments coming on stream at the same time. Helpfully or unhelpfully, all of those developments, as you are aware, were large-scale, you know, capital-intensive apartments and or care buildings. So I think what Catherine and the team are referring to is there's some flexibility, I guess, in terms of how and when and in what proportions we allocate our capital going forward. We're not going to be stuck in the ground for, you know, 3 or 4 years with a, you know, delivery of, you know, 190 apartments or 160 care suites or things of that nature. So that's a long answer to a short, to a question. But yes, capital can moderate from here.
The nuance is that this time 18 months, 24 months ago, we had twice as much under construction as we do at the moment committed, and this time last year had, I think, 409 units. So whether we made new decisions or not, we were committed to those projects, whereas now, whilst we don't, you know, we're not giving guidance as to what those CapEx numbers are going to be, we have more control over, you know, whether we accelerate or delay further development.
Perfect. Makes total sense. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from Stephen Ridgewell with Craigs IP. Please go ahead. Stephen, you're live on the call. You might be on mute.
Yep, apologies, sorry, I was on mute. Just first of all, good to see the pivot and ICA development strategy to more broad acre and general tapering of development activity in the next couple of years. Just first one for Catherine, just for the divestments that you've announced and you know, looking to settle, what is the expected EBITDA impact or underlying EBITDA impact from those divestments, please?
For the future ones, good question. I might have to come back to you on that one. The ones that we've sold to date, it's only about 100k impact. Going forward, it will be between one and a half million. So for FY25, it should be between 1 and 1.5 million.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks. And then I guess just on the improvement in aged care EBITDA we saw in the second half, I mean, it was good to see, you know, following the HB funding increase. I guess just interested, you know, do you see that run rate in the second half as kind of a good base level as we enter kind of the FY25 year? You know, that $12 million per half, is that a sustainable run rate, or there are other kind of cost pressures that we should be mindful of that perhaps it sort of dials back a little bit from where it's been? And then can you also just interest in occupancy exit rate, you know, towards the end of the period?
I think those are good questions, Stephen. We're actually really pleased with the direction of travel in the care business. It's been hard yards. We overinvested during COVID, as you know. We're starting to unwind that. I made a comment a couple of years ago that we'd become full-time recruiters rather than running a business, you know, as we think about the unavailability of sort of clinical staff in particular. So what we're seeing is a very pleasing improvement in our wage to revenue ratios. We're seeing a really, positive improvement in our occupancy. And some of our sites are sitting up around 100%. And, you know, as we're selling through our care suites and some of our new developments, we're seeing EBITDA margins improving. We're seeing bed, if we want to use non-GAAP measures, our EBITDA per bed materially improving. And that's before we get the windfall of some of this new innovation around private paying care and other forms of premiumisation that's occurring in the portfolio. If the government are of a mood to improve funding, then that's a material improvement in our performance. And because we have the right sort of platform in place now, then hopefully what happens is that is true margin improvement for us rather than pass through. So I think from where we're sitting, we are actually seeing for the first time in a long time, you know, a real improvement. Costs coming down, stabilisation of workforce, medical cost inputs are coming down, occupancy is going up, and premiumisation, i.e. the share of the wallet from our residents, is improving our overall kind of financial outcomes.
Cool, that's helpful, thanks. And then maybe if I just go back to ask another question on debt, I guess if we go back to the interim result, you probably asked this question at the time about the direction of travel, and I think the comments that we noted down at the time was an expectation from management that debt would be kind of steady or perhaps down a bit, depending on obviously settlement activity at Helier and a few other things. We've seen net debt sort of pick up about 26 million half and half. I'm just interested, compared to the internal projections that you had, you know, 6 months ago, what was kind of the key line item that was a little bit worse than expected? Was it mainly slower settlements at, you know, the Helier and some other sites? Like, just a little bit more colour would be helpful, please.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. I think probably the key thing is a few of those divestments we thought might have settled in March. So you will have seen we've had another 16 mil of sales proceeds in April and May. We've got another site that's under contract at the moment. Had they fallen into 31 March, then we would be a lot steadier. And as you say, there's a 26 mil uplift. 16 of that is funds that we've received post the balance date. There's also a little bit of insurance funds that we would have hoped to have had by now, but that's kind of trickling through in May and June as well.
Yeah, but also I think if we addressed, we probably expected to be a little bit further along in the sell down of the Helier. The team have done an outstanding job, Stephen, as it relates to sales. 476, it's the best performance we've actually had. All of the markers, from my perspective, are up. But, you know, those were very, very material kind of outcomes for us. So
as Catherine said, $10 million in divestments and $16 million in other elements, and then maybe, two, three, four more sales at the Helier, we'd be back down to our debt starting with a five rather than starting with a six. And so that's probably giving us some of the confidence that you're hearing on the call around this kind of deleveraging and what's actually happening in the business.
Oh, that's helpful, thanks. And just one last question from me again, but maybe putting the front book to one side, maybe just looking at the cash generation from the existing assets, which is something we do, track pretty closely, and you have good disclosure as a company that we can actually work that out. We can't actually work that out for all operators, but so we thank you for that. But I guess if you sort of look at the kind of operating cash flows and you back out net interest, let's allocate that to development, back out the new sales receipts, and then subtract the maintenance capex, I think the company on our numbers kind of burns about $27 million in FY24. And I guess I'm just interested, how much of that is startup losses on new villages? Obviously, there's been a lot of new product that you've come out with in the last few years, and then I guess the pathway, to really get into a positive cash generation from the existing or back book of assets, I think would just be quite helpful how management kind of thinks about that and perhaps the time frame to achieve that as you start to kind of wind down the front, the development book, in the next few years.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. I'll start and then I'll let Brent fill some of the gaps. So you're right about the operating losses. Where we've experienced that the most is on our care developments. And so, as you know, we move over as many residents as we can to make them as efficient as they can from day one, but inevitably until you've got a full building, there will be a little bit of a drag. And Elmwood comes online at the end of this year, so we'll have that impact in 25, but that is really then the last of our brownfield care developments. So we do expect that kind of drag that we've experienced over the last couple of years will disappear in the future. And I might let Brent talk.
Yeah, I think you've covered it, wonderfully, Catherine. I think all that's happened, Stephen, is that we've had this pivot out of care, so we're doing the last of that large-scale premium care, and those assets are really, you've got to operationalise them from day dot, and as a consequence, they come with a pretty heavy operating impact. We're stopping that, we're moving away from that, we feel like we've got a pretty full portfolio now of where we want to be around care. And it goes to my sentiment around, wage to revenues coming down, occupancies going up, but also the disruption that we've had in our numbers in past years. We've decanted residents, undertaking intensive developments around care. We're kind of at the end of that. So Elmwood is the last sort of major, care suite delivery, and therefore people will start to get a confidence around 18,000, including DMF per bed, moving well into the 20s and possibly into the 30s over time. So that's probably what the strategic intent is. We've just got to deliver it to it.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks. Thanks, Tim.
Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from Nick Ma with Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Hi guys, just on the new sales stock, just wondering if you can provide any colour. You kind of mentioned, we'll start reporting it when we get to a appropriate level. Any colour on where you think that should be for the business?
I think that a nice rule of thumb will be when we're at a point where there's nothing over 12 months, really. And so it's kind of the general churn of what we're bringing to market each year. It's coming through. I don't have a magic number, Nick. I'll probably stop disclosing it when people stop asking about it.
I think the other thing that I'd say, Nick, is that we've brought a lot to market, and what's helpful is that of the 350 odd million, there's 50 million that you can't sell anyway because you've got a resident that's already in occupation from previously being decanted. So you're down to 300 million. Of that 300 million, 200 million of it is last 12 months. And I think, the desire is to get through that as quickly as we can. The 88 million that's left over, we're already, we're starting to see really good, kind of applications on that part of the portfolio. So the team are desiring to have, as Catherine said, sort of stock sitting
not less than 12 months old from a seasonality point of view. But, you know, we're starting to make the sort of traction that the market would expect us to be making on the inventories that we've built up.
No, that's great. And then I know there'll be some sort of different views as the new CEO comes in, but sort of medium-term development outlook for this business, I think 250-300 was sort of talked about before. You know, where do you guys stand today?
I think we probably stand to the sort of to the lower of that booking. I don't think we're going to be rewarded for bringing 300 units to market tomorrow, until we can demonstrate that we've got through the stock that we've got. So the desire by the business is always to be in sort of the lower bands of 30%-35% from a gearing perspective. You know, that can change a lot by just having in, you know, your asset values being considered in a different way. But I think the reality is, Nick, that the market is probably tapering. The market is moving to product that, you know, you can see greater and faster recycling of cash, and it's less probably for us in terms of the development of our pipeline around, you know, 250-300 units per year. It's actually right product, right place, and an ability to demonstrate pre-sales and adoption of the product that we're delivering. I think as a consequence of that, you know, we're probably, you know, something starting with a two, rather than ambitiously starting with a three.
And on the back of that, you know, where do you see, you know, that sort of $250 million of undeveloped land and WIP sitting? Where do you think that needs to sit as you transition to that sort of style of cadence of development?
So, you mean in terms of land holding costs? Are you meaning in terms of how quickly we turn that soil? I'm not entirely sure, Nick, what the line of question
Sorry, the sort of $112 million of undeveloped land and $147 million of WIP at the moment, you know, in aggregate, does that need to go up or down or sideways to deliver what you're talking about in terms of the medium-term target build rate?
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. I think for us, you know, we've got enough in the consented pipeline, and we're in locations that we know we've got the right sort of resident at the end of it. But we've always been curious around and intentional around building optionality into the pipeline. We, you know, when we were in more favourite market conditions, we did some acquisitions. Andrew looks at property opportunities every day. There's an availability of land banks. So I think, you know, as market conditions improve, then that allows us to just be a bit more expansionary as we think about key locations that we might not be in that we want to be in. But within the existing portfolio, then, you know, we've got plenty of time just to develop out what we have.
Okay, that's fine. Thanks a lot.
The next question comes from Shane Solly with Harbour Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, and thanks, Brent, for your stewardship at Oceania. I've got two quick questions. The first one, just picking up on the getting cash neutral at the Helier in FY25, what's the sort of key stepping stones to get to cash neutral in FY25?
Not too many more sales, to be honest, Shane. I think the reality is that, you know, this project is going to demonstrate some pretty compelling free cash flow above the original investment. It's also going to develop, it's going to give, you know, a pretty outstanding development margin. We don't put a lot of weight on development margins. Obviously, we focus on cash. But I think from our perspective, if we think about the cadence that we're seeing, if we think about the inquiry, elevated inquiry levels that we've got, you know, we've got a lot of confidence that, you know, a bunch of sales ahead of us get us there pretty quickly and leave plenty of cash for that sort of upside that the market's been expecting.
Great, thank you. Just a second question then. In terms of your confidence to lift your build rate, and I appreciate what you've just indicated to Nick, but just what would actually see you want to lift that build rate? What are the sort of preconditions that you need to see?
Well, I think it's about the confidence of the residents. So if it's a care product, we've got to basically see that there's still a willingness for share of wallet, i.e. government / resident paying combinations. If it's apartments and villas, then that's kind of, you know, right product, right place. So, you know, we've got some fantastic sites that we would accelerate with just some better market conditions. An obvious one is Lady Ellen. We've built a beautiful care building there. It's already, you know, fully occupied and, you know, great reputation. And the site's available for some apartment developments, and those apartments would have outstanding views and be highly attractive to buyers in that precinct, particularly as other participants, other competitors have pulled their, you know, pulled their product in, you know, close proximity to ours. So the market is opening up for us to develop. We need confidence that, you know, residents are going to be able to sell through their houses or be able to sell through their share portfolios or other forms of assets to move into occupation with us.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the time.
The next question is a follow-up question from Eric Abbotson. Please go ahead.
Hey, Brent and Catherine, apologies, but I just need to follow up on your sort of unsold new stock and the valuation of it, because it's, you know, if I look at relative to the half year, you've delivered, what did you deliver in the second half? 120 or something, and then you sold for 60 or something like that, millions. You delivered 120 units, and then you sold for 60 million. So I'm just trying to understand, you know, how this number went down by 69 million or whatever you said on the call. From 14.
Yeah, I think, So I think probably given we are sort of 15 minutes over what we have allocated, Aaron, certainly Catherine and I, Heath, we're here. We're happy to sort of answer that question, and we're happy to make it available for others. So can we take that offline so that we can actually do the maths that you've just done to actually provide the, you know, the right response?
Absolutely. Thank you.
There are no further questions on the teleconference at this time. I'll now hand back to Brent, Catherine and Heath to answer any questions from the webcast.
There was just a question, or there are a couple of questions from the website, but I'm pretty confident that we've covered those anyway. They were actually just around visibility of sales, and I think we've been very transparent about that. There were some comments around debt, and I think we've canvassed that to a degree. We'll certainly circle back on this last question that Aaron's raised. I would say in conclusion, you know, this is my last time doing this for Oceania, and it has been an absolute privilege for me to work with this team. And I love this job very much, and I think Oceania has delivered a fair result to the market. We've got plenty ahead of us, and that's a great opportunity for the incoming CEO. But I do want to thank everybody for their support of our business. We've certainly enjoyed the robustness of these discussions over the years, and we're really proud of what we've done. So thank you for people making time available and engaging with us in the way that you do.
Thank you, everyone.